for over 20 years. I am currently the Allegheny County Bar Association Immigration Committee Chair. I'm a co-chair of the Pennsylvania Bar Association Immigration Law Committee, and I'm have been a past chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association Pittsburgh chapter. So I'm coming on to represent those agencies today, those immigration law committees.
Yeah, that's really a lot. And it's really cool that you do all that. Can you give a little explanation of what that might look like on the day-to-day?
As a practicing immigration lawyer, I mostly handle business and family immigration. I have in the past handled all aspects of immigration law. Typically, I work with universities, hospital systems, private employers, and also families to navigate the immigration process, which is quite complex, almost as complex as the tax code. Maybe even more complex.
I don't know. I just did my taxes. That was pretty rough. Well, we're here to ask you about mostly student immigration because we are a college radio station. So it seems like international students' visas are in the news pretty much every day. How is the situation right now changed from what it was like 2 years ago when I feel like nobody was talking about this?
It's changed dramatically. We have seen an uptick in a lot of student revocations of visas, SEVIS issues. We have seen attacks on universities by this administration, most notably right now with Harvard University being threatened to not be able to have international students because of funding issues as far as just discussions as far as what the administration wants them to do. And we've been seeing that increase in the last 2 or 3 months. In the last 2 or 3 weeks, we've been seeing where the students have had their SEVIS terminated and visas revoked for a number of issues that in the past never were an issue.
Yeah, here at Carnegie Mellon, I know we've had none of the students who have had visas revoked have a criminal record or anything. Maybe they have a DUI that they weren't convicted of or got expunged from the record doing a program, or maybe not even that.
We've seen traffic tickets lead to revocations of visas and SEVIS. Traditionally in the past, if a student had a DUI and was convicted, there were issues with the visa itself. They would revoke the visa, but they would allow the students to continue studies. Now that's no longer the case because they're actually terminating the SEVIS system. So it's definitely increased versus what the Obama administration and Biden administrations had previously done, and even the Trump administration the first time.
So I'm not a lawyer. Can you explain kind of the difference between like the visa system and the SEVIS system?
Well, SEVIS is the student and exchange visitor program that allows the students to actually get into the system. That's what the international office at CMU would do. They would enter and issue the I-20s for the students. The visa itself is granted by the Department of State at the consulate for the international students. So you need both. You need to have an I-20 from the university, and then you need a student visa in order to come to the U.S. and study. In the past, it was never an issue with an individual that had a DUI. They would just remain in the U.S., complete their studies, and then go back and they might have visa issues at that point, but they were able to continue their studies. With the SEVIS system being revoked, the students can no longer attend university studies. There's some debate amongst immigration lawyers whether they're allowed to or not, whether universities are allowed to or not, but we've actually seen where universities that have re-entered the I-20 into the system, they actually have that canceled by ICE. So ICE just basically takes what this university does. If they issue a new I-20, they just cancel it anyway. So we've seen that in practice. It's so basically, once the SEVIS is terminated, there's also a question whether individuals can continue with their EADs if they're on OPT. And there's a debate whether you can or not, but we've seen where most universities will say no, and there's issues with that as well.
Is there a legal justification for this? Could the administrations always just decide to revoke SEVIS and visas?
Well, that's a good question because the law actually reads that the law provides a non-immigrant's conviction and jurisdiction in the United States for a crime of violence for which a sentence of more than 1 year imprisonment may be imposed, and it constitutes a failure to maintain status. So the question is, are these violations crimes of violence up to 1 year imprisonment that's possible? And so far, no. So we've been seeing cases that are not actually convictions. We've seen parking tickets, speeding tickets. We've seen a number of those that have been terminated, even though the law is clear that they should not be. And that's why a lot of attorneys are litigating these in federal courts. There was a recent action in Georgia where I think there were 110 students that were assigned to that, or that had filed with that, a mass action lawsuit against the administration just because of that, and a lot of individualized. And there's a class action here in Pittsburgh that has been filed. So a lot of attorneys are litigating this matter.
So if litigation is successful, would people just be able to return to their studies, or would there still be more needed to figure out after that?
They should be able to just return to their studies, to complete their studies, to fulfill any OPT time that they're allowed, any STEM OPT time that they're allowed, should be able to pursue H-1Bs if they want to do that, or other non-immigrant visas and also immigrant visas. So it basically just corrects the point where they're at the place where they started, allowed to continue with their studies and pursue any additional action later down the line.
Yeah. So, and then how long does litigation take? Like, this seems like it's going to take years out of people's lives.
It could be, yes. It could be years. I'm not a litigator myself, so I'm not filing these, but I'm referring to people that are, and it could be years down the road before this actually comes to fruition. A lot of students at this point have been frustrated and just left. If you leave, you don't really have any options, but it's best to stay and fight and do litigation. A lot of people have discussed whether they could just do reinstatements, but that's filing a reinstatement to go before the same agency that just canceled the visa, and it's not clear that a reinstatement would be successful, and that would be 6 to 12 months down the road that you would get a decision on that reinstatement without the ability to go to school. So that's why a lot of people are filing individual lawsuits or actions with other individuals to try to compel the administration to allow the students to continue with their studies.
If that's what the legal community is doing, is there a role that, you know, the more general community can have in trying to support international students? Because not all of us have law degrees.
I think just in general, if you know international students, support them, talk to them, tell them that you're supportive of them, that they're welcome in the country and in the Pittsburgh community. We have a lot of international students here in Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon in particular, University of Pittsburgh, Duquesne, a lot of universities, and we benefit as a city from the universities greatly. And if we don't have international students that are allowed to come here, that's going to be a real problem for those universities, for the city itself. There's going to be a brain drain. A lot of the individuals are coming here and doing STEM fields, and that's much needed in this area.
I mean, speaking of all the international students here at Carnegie Mellon, we've even got the president got a letter from the administration that seemed pretty threatening about it. Are we going to have to cut back on the amount of international students admitted?
I'm aware of that letter. I've read it. I'm not going to comment specifically what CMU should do. But as far as cutting back on international students, they have threatened to cut international students' ability to go to Harvard. If that's successful, if Harvard does not win that, then potentially everybody down the line could have issues with getting federal funding and the ability to actually allow international students. It might not even be a question of whether CMU does it or not. It might be a matter of, will this administration allow them to?
What would you say is the value of having international students? Because to me, the international students are some of the smartest people in my class half the time.
Yep. And my nephew is actually an international student in the UK, or was. He's now living there, but he was an international student in the UK, so a lot of it's reciprocal. Our U.S. citizens that are traveling abroad and studying abroad, are they going to have issues with being allowed to study in those locations or travel And we're bringing the best and the brightest here to the U.S. to study. I mean, Carnegie Mellon is one of the top in the world for a lot of programs, and they're coming and learning and getting jobs here, and it's going to be a brain drain if we don't allow international students and have a free flow of academia. It's going to be a real problem for industry in years to come. A lot of the people that are in charge of Fortune 500 companies are immigrants. A lot of startups are founded by immigrants. It's going to be a real problem if you don't have immigrants. It's going to drain the U.S. economy. I mean, you look at, just half the world's CEOs, it's going to be an issue. I mean, you look at just the administration itself. A lot of them are immigrants themselves. And if you cut that off, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I'm curious about one thing. What are the constitutional rights of international students when they're studying in the U.S., and how does that differ from citizens?
Well, they should be given due process. Everybody in the U.S. deserves to have due process by being a person that's here in the U.S. So the question is, do they have the same rights to free speech? I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I'm not going to speak to that, other than I would caution people from doing that at this point, just given this administration. You've seen what has been happening to the international students that have been very vocal. Right or wrong, that's an issue that you don't really want to have the administration after you, unless if you want to be a spokesperson or have a target on your back. But they do have rights, to answer your question. International students have rights of due process, just as Americans have rights when we go abroad. You have to be aware of the rights or the laws of the country. That's something to be concerned about. But what is happening, these individuals are not criminals. They're basically, their free speech rights, they should have First Amendment rights. If somebody has a traffic incident, they should be able to resolve that and continue their studies. It should not lead to immigration action where their visas are canceled for a parking ticket or a speeding ticket. DUI is a different matter, but they should be allowed the process of the law in order to continue with that. Obviously, there's visa revocations that were happening. It started under the Obama administration, where if somebody had a DUI, they would revoke the visa, but they were allowed to straighten it out and they were allowed to continue studies, and it was an issue. But what would happen is they just wouldn't leave the U.S. So you don't have full rights of a U.S. citizen, but you do have a lot of rights. And you might want to discuss any situations with an immigration lawyer as far as if you're planning on departing the U.S., ability to return to the U.S. There are guidance as far as electronic devices that you might want to look at as far as what you can and can't carry and what you should be doing. But obviously, you want to abide by the laws of the U.S., but the U.S. does need to grant everybody that's here due process and rights under the law.
So what would be your advice for current international students? Because you said maybe be careful about speaking unless you're willing to take a lot of risk. Do you have other advice?
I mean, caution in travel. What types of, your cell phone, and this is to U.S. citizens as well, your cell phone can be searched at the border. Your computer can be searched at the border. U.S. citizens are guaranteed admission. Lawful permanent residence, it's a little bit dicey. You can be put into removal proceedings, but international students and international visitors, they can be refused admission to the U.S., so that's something to be cautious of. Obviously, everybody wants to go somewhere for spring break. Everybody wants to go see family, but if you're concerned about travel, it's safest not to travel sometimes, especially if you're one semester away, finish your studies. But then the question comes to OPT and STEM OPT, and you hate to have people captive in the U.S. where they can't leave the U.S., but sometimes for international students, it does seem like that the safest approach is not to travel, which is very sad.
Yeah. Is there any other way you should try and be safe, or do you just try and keep your head down, don't travel, and just hope to continue your studies?
I'd say talk to other people, make people aware of what you're doing, have contacts where people can get a hold of you, have if you're picked up by ICE, you should have an immigration attorney that you can contact. Removal defense, there's many good removal defense attorneys in Pittsburgh. I myself don't handle those types of cases, but anybody that has questions, they can certainly contact me, and I can funnel out to immigration attorneys that might be able to handle those types of situations. I would say just make sure that people are aware of, your surroundings, aware of you. If you're picked up by immigration, you might have to have points of contact in order to navigate the process. Make sure your family knows, how to get a hold of you. Friends know how to get a hold of you.
This is Forbes Avenue. We're interviewing Mark Hurley about immigration law. So I know you're associated with CMU in immigration. What does that look like from your perspective?
We do business-based immigration for the university. There are several attorneys that have been designated to do university work and recommended by the university to do work on behalf of students. So it's a referral list. So it's a pleasure and a privilege to work with CMU and to handle immigration matters for them.
I'm curious about one sort of legal machinery that goes on here. The review process and hearing process for challenging these revocations of visas, does that go through the State Department and the agencies responsible for issuing the visas, or is that through the courts, like a traditional legal case?
Well, right now, SEVIS is just being terminated by ICE. And if you're trying to do anything through ICE or the Department of Homeland Security, it's probably a wasted cause as far as, like I said, the reinstatement, filing those, because it goes to the same agency, USCIS, that is the ones that had done it within the Department of Homeland Security. So ICE ends it, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and you hear before USCIS. So that's why most people are not doing that route. Most people are taking it directly to federal court with a federal judge. So district court judges will be the ones that hear that, potentially up to the circuit court level, and then potentially up to the Supreme Court. So it's in front of federal judges, not immigration judges, federal judges.
What's the difference between an immigration judge and a federal judge? Because I've heard say, know your rights. If you have a warrant signed by an immigration judge, you don't have to comply necessarily.
Correct.
So what's that difference?
They're within the Department of Justice. They're basically an administrative law judge, whereas a federal judge is sitting within the executive branch. They're not an agency judge as if an immigration judge. An immigration judge works for the agency. They're not an actual judicial official. They are a judge. You have to refer to them as judge, but they are not a federal judge that has the authority to do a lot of the things the federal judges are doing right now to stop some of the actions that the administration is doing.
So under the current law, are visas sort of at will by the executive branch, or do they have to provide some sort of legal reason to revoke them?
They should provide a legal reason to revoke them, but right now that's where a lot of these lawsuits are coming, because they're not doing the actual Procedures Act that they're supposed to be doing. So a lot of these, as we indicated, are being canceled. They are saying that the individual students aren't maintaining status for violations that aren't actually violations or should not be violations. So the termination of a lot of these visas is improper, according to most immigration lawyers. There are proper terminations of, obviously if the person stops going to school, that's a violation of status. If they have jobs that they're not allowed to have, that's a violation of status. Certain crimes are a violation of status. But when is a speeding ticket or a traffic ticket or a disorderly conduct that is never actually a conviction, that's not.
I also hear that a lot of the time people aren't even notified until later that they're getting their status revoked. Is that proper, or is this another way where we're doing shortcuts in ways that might not be?
Yeah, it's not proper. They should be being notified, but obviously there's gaps in the system, but I know most universities are getting those and letting the students know right away and trying to help the students as much as possible. And I understand that that's what CMU is doing as well, trying to help the students as much as possible. But the administration has handcuffed a lot of the universities as far as what they can do. As I said, they have you know, some universities were trying to re-enter people in I-20s, and they were just being canceled. So it's a lot of times it is just litigation that has to take place in order to resolve these issues because the administration is doing improper things.
What's your outlook over the next couple of years of this administration on the topic of revoking visas for international students? Do you think it's going to continue, or do you think this trend will be stopped by the current wave of litigation?
It depends on what the federal judges start doing. If they stop the administration from doing them, if they reinstate the students in the SEVIS, if they say you can't cancel the visas, then the administration will stop. If the federal judges allow it to happen, then it will continue to happen. So, and we'll probably see this over the course of the next few years as far as any minor traffic or any minor criminal encounter is going to lead to issues for an international student.
How does this kind of fall within the larger context of immigration law and how that's changing in the United States?
We've seen a lot of changes from the Biden administration to the Trump 2.0 administration. We've definitely seen a lot more vetting that is, you know, and to me as an immigration lawyer, a lot of it does not make sense. A lot of these things are happening and they're just duplicating efforts. We've been seeing a lot of it's hard to say what exactly, but the due process is one of the biggest issues as far as immigration saying that they can go into any school, go into any church, go into any place where people are gathered, hospital systems to encounter people and remove them from the U.S. instead of allowing those agencies to just continue to have the, you know, where people can go and get treatment for an illness, where students can be safe in their classroom without intrusion by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So a lot of it is things that in previous administrations were taken for granted. This administration, I understand there is enforcement that has to take place, but there should be proper time and places to do that. And we've seen a lot of that, just the changes within this administration that are very harsh for immigrants as far as the populations are concerned.
So in terms of that larger context of immigration, going into classrooms, going into schools and churches and hospitals, I think that there's also been more immigration control enforcement activity on campus. And there's definitely rumors. So how is that affecting things?
Yeah, I mean, it was the revocation of a ICE memo, a policy memo on sensitive locations, where that's what happened a few, probably about 2 months ago, early in the administration, that ICE said that we're going to take that away, so we're going to go anywhere. And now they are starting to. We've seen activity on college campuses. It's something that we have seen more, but obviously like high school, elementary school, the optics of going into a classroom and picking up a first grader, and they actually have. We've had stories of them interviewing elementary school students and going into classrooms. It's rare, and I don't think they're going to try to do that, but it's just the fact that they can now and are willing to do that is concerning, that they're willing to go and take those steps.
It seems, at least from a non-experienced legal ear such as mine, that many of the things that we take for granted about the immigration system are sort of convention. Do you foresee that a lot of these questions that are coming up now are going to get encoded into law, either in this administration or the next?
I don't know that they will have significant changes in the law, because immigration law has been the same for a long time. They haven't changed significantly since the 90s and then before that in the 80s. So for the past 30 years, they've done no significant immigration legislation. So I don't know that there's going to be changes in the law. It's just really how the law is interpreted and enforced that we've seen. Now it's a lot harsher than it had been in the past. So I think the last reform was 1994, so it's been almost 30 years. But the last was in 1986, there was overhauls. So it's been a long time, and most of the immigration laws are antiquated. They do need updates, but you need compromise and, you know, Congress to act to compromise to pass legislation. And I don't know that we're going to see that anytime soon. They haven't done anything significant in years as far as Congress is concerned.
So given all these laws are so antiquated, is it currently just up to ICE and the administration to interpret them?
Well, that's where the judges come in, and lawsuits by attorneys filing on behalf of their clients to make sure that the government is doing proper due process rights of those individuals and not just making up as they go.
You're basically saying that we're currently making history in terms of how immigration is changing in the United States. So when was the last time that we had such changes? Was it under Obama with like DACA, or was it back, you know, in the 90s? Or has this sort of thing been happening in the background slowly and nobody's noticed until now?
I mean, I think we've always had immigration changes throughout our whole history. We've treated certain populations poorly in the past, not given rights to the Chinese. We had Chinese Exclusion Acts. We detained Japanese during World War II. We've always had issues with how we've treated certain individuals, and unfortunately now we're doing it again, just not giving due process rights to a lot of individuals. So the law has been, I think, pretty, I mean, they had Immigration Control Acts in the 80s and 94. They had Immigration Control Acts. So they've always been doing those types of things to enforce who can come into the U.S. and who can't. And that's every country's right to do that. It's just the question is, are we doing it properly with due process and our enforcement now?
International students at CMU and universities around the country, I have to assume, are kind of terrified right now of the potential consequences of some of these actions by the administration. What advice do you have to them personally to deal with the situation?
I wish I could give advice. It's hard because I'm not in their position. But I would say have support groups, reach out to the university, tell the university your concerns. Reach out to members of Congress, reach out to the U.S. senators' offices, tell them their concern. Every international student is paying a lot of money to come to school here, paying full tuition, and they're an asset to the community, and they should be heard as far as their fears and their concerns.
All right, we are running a little low on time. Do you have anything else you want to say?
I would say just reach out to an immigration lawyer if you have any concerns, if you want to address immigration issues that you, or questions that you have. We can certainly navigate the process, or I can assist in pointing out attorneys that might be able to assist in the process. If you do have one of the revocations, reach out to an attorney right away. There are courses of action you can take through immigration attorneys. I wouldn't say just don't give up. Eventually, I think that things will sort of settle themselves out. Right now, it is a lot of confusion, a lot of unknowing, and I think the best thing you can do is reach out for your friends and family for support, to the university for support, and contact an immigration lawyer if you have any questions.
Thank you so much. This has been Forbes Avenue. I'm Rihanna Duncan, and I have
Arjun Das
here. We're interviewing Mark Hurley about immigration law. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruisin' the Decades, Brian. Brad Savage. If I snare Brad Savage.
A little bit of magic in your ears around the world as the transmission begins now. This is Cruising the Decades. Over 100 years of music in 1 hour. A musical time travel history journey. And this is show number 150, CruisingTheDecades.com. On today's show, remembering Brian Wilson. And we'll join in the chant of remembrance for UK industrial artist Douglas McCarthy. And something about Spearmint or Bubblegum Overnight, a song you won't believe is as old as it really is. Also, the singing governor of Louisiana with a number one hit while he was in office in 1945. In the 90s, an animation meets live action film with a bunch of heavy hitters on the soundtrack. One song per decade on Cruising the Decades, and we're going to begin with a song that goes back to 1911 and 1912. It was one of the biggest songs of the day. And recently, my 11-year-old son, David, and I stayed up real late and watched the movie Titanic. He likes 80s and 90s films. He likes the storytelling more than the big action and the special effects of today. So we really got into the story and the history of Titanic. Well, the RMS Titanic sank in April of 1912 in the North Atlantic. And in the movie, I didn't remember this because I haven't seen that film in 15 years. In the movie, a couple times they reference a very popular song of the day, Come Josephine in My Flying Machine. It dates back to 1911 by Ada Jones and Billy Murray, a duet of two of the biggest popular singers of the day. Let's start the show with Come Josephine in My Flying Machine on Cruising the Decades.
All day, let us fly, dear.
Where, kid?
To the sky, dear.
Oh, you flying machine.
Jump in, Miss Josephine.
Yip, ahoy!
Oh, joy, what a feeling.
We'll go through the ceiling, oh, high.
Hoopla, we fly to the sky so high.
Come, Josephine, in my flying machine. Going up, she goes, balance yourself like a bird on a beam in the air. She goes, there she goes, up, up, a little bit higher. Oh my, the moon is on fire. Come Josephine in my flying machine, going up, hold on, goodbye.
Moon.
Oh, no. Not yet, but soon you for me.
not me. I'm a sky kid, gee. I'm up in the air about you for sale.
Come Josephine in my flying machine, going up. She goes up, she goes. Balance yourself like a bird on a beam in the air. She goes, there she goes. Up, up, a little bit higher. Oh my, the moon is on fire. Come Josephine in my flying machine, going up, all on goodbye.
Improvements in recording technology and the evolution of musical styles of popular music through the decades and beyond. Over 100 years of music. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades, broadcast worldwide on AM, FM, and shortwave.
To do. Hallelujah, the question is peculiar. It's got me on the go. I give a lot of dough. If someone here would tell me, is it yes or is it no? Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
If you chew it in the morning, will it be too hard to bite?
Can't you see I'm going crazy? Won't somebody push me right?
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
The nation rose as one and sent its favorite son to the White House. This mighty country's lighthouse.
He saw the president. He said that I've been sent to solve the burning question that involves the continent.
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Would you use it on your collar when your bun's not in sight?
Put your hand beneath your seat and you will find it there all right.
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
If your teacher tells you not to chew it, swallow it for spite.
Could you grab it with your tonsils and then swing it left and right?
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Here comes a blushing bride, the boob right at her side. So the altar as steady as Gibraltar.
The bridegroom has the ring. It's such a pretty thing.
He puts it on her finger and the choir begins to sing. Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Always taste it on your napkin if you want to be polite.
Could you get a job as typist if you couldn't do it right?
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Well, it makes a fellow shut up when he's dying to recite.
Would you give it to your parent if he isn't cursing right?
Does the spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?
Cruising the Decades, 100 years of music history. If you know your oldies era music, you probably know the chewing gum version of that song, which was a hit in 1959 by British skiffle singer Lonnie Donegan. However, it goes back quite a ways before that. You just heard Billy Jones and Ernest Hare. Does the Spearmint lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight? It was released in 1924 by the Happiness Boys. That's the duo of Hare and Jones. And it was covered a few times, several different recordings leading up to the 1959 revival. And then it even ended up on the Muppet Show. So, you know, it was really a huge pop culture moment into the 60s and 70s. As we go to the Artie Shaw Orchestra in 1939. Our 30s selection this week is when Artie Shaw was working with vocalist Helen Forrest. And this is Day In, Day Out. This is a Johnny Mercer composition, in fact. Artie Shaw's orchestra on Cruisin' the Decades.
An obsessive lifelong collection of records and music history into a global broadcast of one song per decade. For over 100 years of popular recordings, you're hearing Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage on the best radio broadcast signals across North America and the world, AM, FM, and shortwave. This is Cruisin' the Decades.
The singing governor of Louisiana. This was a number one hit in 1945 when Governor Jimmy Davis was in office. This is called There's a New Moon Over My Shoulder on Cruisin' the Decades.
There's a new moon over my shoulder and an old love in my heart. I remember now that I'm old what you told me the day we had to part. You promised with the new moon you'd be coming back to me, but many moons have passed and I'm waiting patiently. There's a new moon over my shoulder and an old love in my heart. Waiting patiently, there's a new moon over my shoulder and an old love in my heart.
That's Jimmy Davis. There's a new moon over my shoulder, a big hit in 44 and 45. Now, he wrote that song, and he served as governor of Louisiana from 1944 to 1948, and then went back into office again from 1960 to 1964. Now, you may know that song by Tex Ritter. Tex had the original hit with it. Other artists to do that song include Jim Reeves and Bill Haley and the Comets and Wanda Jackson and Mack Wiseman and Moon Mullican. They all did that song. It's kind of a country standard, but I find that fascinating that he was a sitting governor in office while he was riding the folk and country music charts in the 1940s. Cruisin' the Decades. 100 years of music history. I'm Brad Savage. A special salute to our high-power shortwave radio listeners. We transmit all over the world on shortwave radio. We get listener reception reports and QSL requests from listeners all over the world. We're heard on WRMI Radio Miami International and also on Germany's Channel 292 shortwave from Rohrbach, Germany, and we're heard on WBCQ, The Planet, in northern Maine, right up near the U.S. and Canadian border. Shortwave is way cool. Let's get into the 1950s, the raucous rock and roll instrumental sounds. This song didn't need lyrics, didn't need a vocal. It was tough, and it's still tough today, nearly 70 years on. This is Link Wray and his Wray Men on Cruisin' the Decades.
Hey,
radio journey, song by song, through every genre of popular music and recorded music history, from swing, jazz, folk, and blues, and the Great American Songbook, to punk, new wave, garage, and alternative. This is the Global Edition of Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. 100 years of music, one song per decade.
We've recently lost a true legend of American popular and rock and roll music, remembering Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, who passed away at age 82. This is the Beach Boys' first hit single from 1961.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf. With bob, dip, 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 bob, dip, dip. I got up this morning, turned on my radio. I was checking out the surfing scene to see if I would go. And when the DJ tells me that the surfing is fine, that's when I know my baby and I will have a good time. Go and surf, bob, dip, 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 surf, bob, dip, dip, surf, bob, dip, 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 surf, bob, dip, dip. Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf with me.
Bob, dip, 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 bob, dip, dip.
From the early morning to the middle of the night, anytime a surf is up, the time is right. And when the surf is down to take its place, we'll do the surfer stomp. It's the latest dance craze.
Bob, dip, 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 bob, dip, 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 bob.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf with me.
Bob, dip, 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 bob, dip, dip.
Now the dawn is breaking and we really gotta go, but we'll be back here very soon, that you better know. Yeah, my surfing knots are rising and my board is losing wax, but that won't stop me, baby, 'cause you know I'm coming back. Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Come on, pretty baby, and surf with me, yeah.
Bop, dip, 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 bop, bop, dip, dip.
Always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on. Believe me, the world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
God only knows what I'd be without. God only knows.
We had to go with two of them from Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, including God Only Knows and Surfin'. Cruising the Decades, remembering a musical genius, Brian Wilson. I'm Brad Savage, and we're moving into the 1970s now with a British glam rock group called Mud. Virtually unknown in the United States, this song basically didn't even chart in the U.S., but it was a big hit in the U.K. and other parts of the world. In fact, it was the U.K.'s highest-selling single of 1974. They're in the world with Sweet and Slade and a lot of the glam rock, the early Bowie type stuff. This group is Mud. Here's Tiger Feet from 1974. Cruising the Decades. Glam rock band Mud from 1974. That is out of the way, way back archive.